Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and our guest today is the comedic wizard known as Greg Proops.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Hello, Jesse. Hello,
comedic
Leonard.
Comedic wizard.
Well, you are.
Hello,
you
Maltesers.
Are. And also, of course, film buff extraordinaire.
Yes.
I am. My wife and I are putting on, what are we showing? Well, by the time this goes out, it'll have been shown. We're showing Ministry of Fear, the Fritz Lang thriller from 44 tonight.
Wow.
With Ray Milland.
With Ray Milland over at the Arrow Theater. We've moved from the Egyptian. We were showing stuff at the Egyptian.
Yeah.
And then we moved over to the Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Which has a very dedicated audience.
There, you know what? I whined and sniveled like a cur all the way there, and then I complained about where we parked. My wife recounted all this to me this morning, and then she was like, when it was over, you were like, I like the crowd better. There was more women. I like the location. The Egyptian's nice, but they get a lot of dude film buffs.
Yes,
so
yes.
Occasionally it's good, and occasionally it's
creepy. Arrow is also like a neighborhood movie house in Santa Monica.
Yes.
It really is.
They show matinees on Tuesdays.
I just wish with all my heart that they could build a parking lot. I know it's not
or
possible.
Or anything resembling one.
Right. I would take three spaces. I would have anything.
Now, we're talking L.A. stuff
yes,
here.
Yes, very.
I usually don't, but it's worth taking a moment just to say that the American Cinematheque operates in two locations, the historic Grauman's Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, and the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica.
Where you were last night.
Where I was last night for Pete Hammond's screening series.
Oh, fantastic.
And they attract two entirely different audiences.
Yeah.
All they have in common is that they love movies. But they're two very distinct audiences in two what are, for L.A., considered remote locations from one another. So people who tend to live on the west side in Santa Monica don't want to schlep all the way to Hollywood, and I don't blame them. And people who tend to live on this side or in the valley where we reside don't really want to make the trek out to Santa Monica. Although it's really not that bad if you go.
As your wife will point out, we all go, oh, God, it's such a pet. And then you get there, you thought, this is nice.
No.
Yeah.
And it's so lovely out there, and it's cool,
it
and
is.
There's ocean air and everything.
It is.
So the atmosphere changes.
Yeah.
But yeah, in L.A. to get someone to go from the Valley to Santa Monica at 7 o'clock at night, you might as well just ask them for their family because they're not going to do it. People here, I'll go to Ireland for a cup of coffee, but people will not drive across L.A. to see you or participate in your reindeer games.
Your friends move away and that's the end of it. Oh, you're in Santa Monica now. Well, it was great.
Yeah, I loved,
we had
I
a lovely life.
You.
That's it.
So tell us a little more about your film series and what the is there a premise or a kind of a overview of it?
I think you'll like the we only have two criterion for our pictures that we show. My wife Jennifer and I, you've met my wife Jennifer. She does most of the programming, let's be honest. I've picked in 5 years, maybe four pictures. I think I picked Sexy Beast and what's the Hitchcock one? Lifeboat, Big Sleep. I think those are my big picks, but almost everything is hers. Last month we showed Babette's Feast.
Oh, wonderful. I haven't seen this since it was new.
Oh, my God. It holds up so well. The writing is so beautiful, and that director has such a wonderful, warm touch.
Wow.
In any case, the two criteria for our movies are, is it under 2 hours, and is it awesome?
I mean, that's in our home. That's the ideal there.
No 2001, no Lawrence of Arabia, no Tarkovsky, because... Mm-hmm. Those pictures are beautiful pictures and they should be shown, but not at a club where I get up and talk for half an hour first.
Yes.
You're going to go to sleep if you have to sit through 25 minutes of me and then a 2.5 hour movie or a 4 hour movie. And then lately, especially since, you know, the gloom clouded over the world when Orange 45 came in. we've been much more political, and it's been 9 to 5. And I mean, we get goofy. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And,
yes.
Well, I was going to say Hairspray, but Hairspray is a very topical movie. Hairspray is not just a comedy. Hairspray is a delightful meditation on race and class.
It's got something to say.
Yeah. Mm.
It definitely does.
So that's the kind of thing. So we showed Babette's Feast because it's such a powerful. If you don't know the plot of it, she's thrown out of France after during the revolution in the 1870s, the communard one, and the sexy one that's always depicted, you know, where they have really cool hats and the high-waisted pants, you know, and that French Revolution, not the first one with the powdered wigs. And the one with where the Prussians invade, and they ate all the animals in the zoo. Anyway, she's chucked out of France. She's lost her family, and she moves to this remote Scandinavian village where no one's nice at all and has no feelings. And
It's remote and barren.
Oh, no. The scape is just, you know, I would say Bergman-esque, but it's not quite that picturesque. And she wins the lottery. This doesn't spoil the plot at all because everything happens after this.
Right.
With an old lottery ticket from Paris, and with her money, unbeknownst to everyone in the village, she's a superb chef. And she puts on this to die for dinner for everybody, all the bigwigs in the village. And an old person from her past comes, and the food releases all of their emotions. So throughout the second part of the picture, when they eat, it's this astonishing food movie about how all of a sudden memories come rushing back and alliances are forged, anger is forgotten, hatred is laid down. Like they're such a provincial, parochial, horrible religious village that's bound by their terrible, you know, Nordic Christianity. And then this meal turns them into singing, dancing, you know, drunk, happy people.
Yeah.
It's a movie that makes you feel drunk, kind of.
Yeah.
It's an intoxicating movie.
That's a wonderful way to put it. And she buys a crate of French champagne.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the more sophisticated diners goes, oh, a Lafitte, you know, 1863, you know, oh my God, when you try this. And then they all, you know, and I was in Paris. And all that.
No, it's a perfect movie. And when it came out, to my eternal regret, I was out of town when the publicists who were handling the movie staged the feast.
Oh, no, they didn't.
They did. They did. They duplicated, they replicated the feast as portrayed in the movie. And I didn't get to partake.
Oh, no. It's like an 8-course. It's stunning.
Yeah.
There's the little popovers and the seafood and the oysters and then the running tandem of game and, oh, my God. And the drink, they're drinking. And so the star is Stéphane Audran, who's an icon of French cinema. And she's just astonishing in this movie because her personal power and the quiet.
Yeah, there's
authority.
A presence. There's a definite presence there. Yeah. Mm. Wowie.
What started you and your wife doing this?
You know, that's so funny. I can't remember.
Did TCM come first? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, so TCM, a guy named Scott McGee, who works there,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Who I'm sure you're quite familiar with. I was playing at Atlanta once, and he actually had read my book. Which I forced on you guys. And there's lots of film in the book. And he brought me in to do an interview. And then he was reading me back some of the things I'd written. And I thought, this is where it all... You're used to this, Leonard. But I was like, uh-oh, now I have to stand by the things that I wrote about movies and hope that they're still instructive and or perceptive or bring any light whatsoever. So he interviewed me at TCM there. And then he asked me to do a couple of different ones. So I did Pirate Month. I hosted Pirate Month. And then a year or two ago, they did Slapstick Month. And I hosted Slapstick Month. And, you know, I'm an okay actor. But when it's Wheeler and Woolsey, it's very difficult to act like you're happy about presenting this movie. You know, when it was Mad, Mad World or Laurel and Hardy or even the long, what's the long trailer? Is it
the long,
Lucy?
Long trailer.
You know, those are fun movies. Even though Mad, Mad World is way too long and all over the yard.
You are talking to, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yeah, please.
You're I was going to say, you can't.
who is a Wheeler and Woolsey fan.
You love Wheeler and Woolsey.
Unlike my wife.
Ah.
Who... I have to admit, this is, you know, no truth shall be obscured here. I once emptied the Museum of Modern Art Auditorium in New York by showing Diplomaniacs. it was kind of a special film series for late afternoon with kind of a cocktail film series for, I guess, for singles.
Sure.
And, you know, an activity for adults.
A cocktail for singles with movies. So like I showed Mueller like
six. I was going to say, there's the picture to show. Don't show the Pink Panther.
No.
Don't show Breakfast at Tiffany's.
No.
It's like 6 weeks of comedy films. And to Alice's, not delight, but her satisfaction.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. To her satisfaction. I emptied out the whole place.
Mm-hmm.
But I stand by my feelings for them.
Well, your personal feelings are, of course, yours to cherish and burnish as you will and raise as a pony.
It's lonely. It's a lonely life.
I have some things that I like that no one else likes. Like, I love Laurel and Hardy, and I watched the John C. Reilly, Steve Coogan picture on the plane. Or I didn't get to watch all of it because I started it too late in the flight. We'd come back from London. But I saw a good deal of it, and I skipped around. And I thought they did a dandy job in it. But my wife just can't stand Laurel and Hardy. And I think they're hysterically funny. Buster Keaton, she will watch any Buster Keaton movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, she's like, no. I don't know. I can't explain it. Jackie Gleason either. She detests Jackie Gleason. My wife has a superb sense of humor, the most sophisticated sense of humor of anyone I've ever met. French comedies, all of them, you know, anything, a comedy manners like that. She gets the hippest references, you know, Lenny Bruce, whatnot, Lily Tomlin. But when it comes to the old pictures, Marx Brothers, I could always get her to watch a Marx Brothers. She loves the Marx Brothers.
Okay, she's earning her way back, but I'm struggling.
Yeah, Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, she will just leave the room, you know. If I'm watching it, it's you know. Yeah, I know.
That's true love, is what that is.
The other thing that we have in common is we will watch the worst Jerry Lewis movie, like the 60s, the late 60s
ooh,
ones.
Ooh, ouch.
We're getting into the Don't Raise the Bridge,
way
the River.
Yeah,
what's the one where it's at the Japanese Tea Garden and George Takei's in it, and that one's just awful.
God.
And there's a close-up of him at one point, Jerry, and he's wearing like white-faced kabuki makeup, and his eyes are burning centroids of drugs. They're like red, bloodshot, just terrible, murderous. And he's kind of yellowy at that point, and you're like, wow, dude, this was a really... Was this Paramount? Kind of late in there.
Oh, you're talking about Geisha Boy?
Geisha Boy, is it?
That's an early one.
No, not the Geisha Boy one. There's a 60s one that's got an Asian theme. And he ends up on the beach with a voiceover, which is the last redoubt of We Had Nothing.
Oh, the Big Mouth? No.
I can't remember the name of it.
Big Mouth, that's on the beach.
We'll watch those ones. I mean, obviously the Martin and Lewis ones are grand. And the early solo stuff is fabulous. But
right. So TCM has you come in and do that.
Yes, I'm a king of tangents.
Which is great. It's okay. I've got you. You should also, as a good author, you should say the name of your book.
It's The Smartest Book in the World. And the podcast, my usual podcast is... The Smartest Man in the World. And then the film club, we decided early on we were going to give it a hilarious name like Proop Loops or something, you know. And then we went with the Greg Proops Film Club to make it extraordinarily clear when posting it online what you were going to get.
As
it is a club where you come and I talk about the film and then I try to hip you to a free version.
As one of my heroes, Robert Benchley, once said, trite is right.
Yeah.
And there are times when that's true.
Yep. If I'd called it Proopaloops or you know, through the Maltese Cross or, you know, some arcane film nonsense, it would have just confused and baffled people. Instead, it's a fun affair. You know, I usually riff for half an hour. I try to find something interesting rather than – unless I really feel strongly about the picture. Like Babette's Feast, I wanted to talk about, you know, how the director approached it and everything. Mm-hmm. And tonight I'll talk about Lang, I think, because Lang is such an insane figure in film.
Yeah, he sure is.
And this isn't even considered one of his biggies.
Oh, no, this is kind of considered almost a throwaway.
Yeah, he didn't – there's a Peter Bogdanovich book, Who the Devil Made It, and I was rereading it today. Bogdanovich basically goes through every movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's his interview style. This is from the 60s. And then he gets to Ministry of Fear and he goes, oh, yeah, I like Graham Greene. Lang says, I like Graham Greene. I really liked it. I watched it on TV the other night and it was cut to pieces. I fell asleep. And I was like, so there goes my insight from that book.
Okay.
I have to.
At least he didn't put it down.
No, he didn't say he hated it. Because Metropolis, of course, he went back and said he hated Metropolis. But that was because the Nazis loved it.
Yeah.
And I think he was real upset that.
Well, and his wife, who turned out to be a Nazi,
wrote it.
Yes. Yeah.
Tia, is it? Thea?
Yeah.
Yes. His wife, yes.
Peter, what was he interviewing you for?
Oh, the Buster Keaton documentary.
Yeah, he's at our house, which was strange enough to open your door and Peter Bogdanovich walks in. But then he's sitting in my dad's office and we have two dogs, one of them very friendly. And Hercules puts his paws up on Bogdanovich's lap. And Bogdanovich just goes, hello, dog. And it's like the funniest thing that's ever happened in my life of Hercules just going, hi, 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 yeah. Hello, dog. I lost it.
He's so dry.
It was perfect. It was perfect, though. He's not going to go, who's a cute boy?
No, no, no.
Who's a good boy? Peter McDonough. Of course not. Of course not. He might mess up the cravat.
I was going to say, the everlasting cravat.
That's right.
He was at my gym for years, and I never spoke to him. And he probably knew that I'm sick with it because I give off that vibe. And but I kept out of his way, and he would work out dutifully wearing sweatpants, a blue Oxford shirt, and a cravat.
Perfect.
And so finally I spoke to him after years because he'd made that gigantic, God rest his soul, Tom Petty documentary.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was the sprawling affair that was like 5 hours or some nonsense. I didn't know there was enough to show, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a fan, but not. And I don't think I have 5 hours for Tom Petty.
No, as Tom Petty will tell you, he doesn't remember most of it.
Yeah.
That's
right. So I went to him. We were in the locker room together, and he was in his, both of us fully dressed, I assure you. No one ever showered at this gym.
Yeah.
It's a Hollywood gym, so you know, you got back in your expensive car. Right. And, I said, Mr. Bogdanovich, may I ask you a question? And he went, certainly. And I went, were you a fan of Tom Petty before you took this project on? He goes, not at all. I'd never heard of them, really. And I go, well, the impetus for doing this? They asked me. And I was like...
You can't argue with that, right?
Because I remember when that came out, Tom Petty was like really getting tired of the road at that point, and he said... Something that I've never agreed with, and I disagree with utterly still, even though he's swirling in the heavens. He said, you go on these long tours and you do all these shows, and what have you got at the end of the day? You've just done a bunch of great live shows. And I'm like, that's the point of being
a performer. Right,
yeah.
Like, I don't think Bob Dylan, who's the most curmudgeonly, or Van Morrison, who's, a ghastly little troll, I don't think they would say that. I think they'd say, I love playing live. That's why I do a million dates a year.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I'm a person when I'm in front of the mic. Mm-hmm. When I'm not, I don't think you really want to hang out with them. But to see them live, that's when the magic, that's why they're magic. They're your poets.
And yeah.
Your poetry has to be expressed. And but I thought it was the funniest thing to say. All you've got is you've done a bunch of great live shows. I'm like, but...
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't you be and now you've made a giant movie that forever anyone who didn't get to see one of your great live shows can now watch this testament to your, like The Last Waltz or like, you know, mm-hmm. the Talking Heads picture that Jonathan Demme did, which was beautifully done because he didn't interview anyone. It's simply the movie. If you've ever seen that one, Stop Making Sense. Mm-hmm. It's from a tour they did in the late 80s. Huh. And it has a lot of Parliament Funkadelic in the band. So it's a very funky concert. And they jump and they run and everything. But there's none of this, you know. Yeah, well, you know, when we got the idea to do this tour. Because who wants? Yawn. Yeah. It's only good in The Last Waltz because you know they already hate each other and they've broken up and they're all coked up and smoking. And so it makes it fun when they talk to them because they sing and they play and they fight with each other. And they disagree. But most concert films, like, you know, I'll go with the Watt Stacks, Woodstock. Mm-hmm. You know, Woodstock's beautiful because they, you know, show people.
Get the ambience.
They show interaction and there's motif of when it's taking place.
Did I just say ambience?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to. I meant to say ambiance.
Ambiance, yes.
Well, anyway, so then I did the TCM things and I did the slapstick one. And yes, the Wheeler and Woolsey. I can't remember which one it was. But I remember Scott saying to me, so you're not as enthusiastic about the Wheeler and Woolsey? Because I had to go like, this next hilarious slapstick classic. You know, Turner Classic Movies is proud to present at the Dazzling Variety here on Slapstick. Ouch, a month celebration. And this next one is 1940. Black and white classic drink. Wheeler and Woolsey.
I was going to say,
a lot of people commented on your on the way you
introduced the happiest millionaire. I just did my last, this aired my last Treasures of the Disney Vault evening on TCM, and in which I was enthusiastic about almost everything.
They're wonderful pictures.
But we showed Walt's last film, the last live action film he produced. That followed immediately, I think. But The Happiest Millionaire, which
with
was
Tommy
a
Steele.
Big scale, yes, with a big scale musical that was not
the
a success.
And all that.
Oh, yes.
Fortuosity, whatever the song
is. Yeah, that's right. So an old acquaintance from Chicago emailed me and said, I expressed my misgivings about the film as mildly as possible, but I said them. And this guy wrote to me and he said, I thought you were kind of harsh in your setup of The Happiest Millionaire. And then I watched it. He says, and when it came to Fortuosity, I said, why would I ever doubt Leonard? It was a very flattering email. Very flattering email.
What was your face like when you were introducing it?
I can only imagine.
Of discomfiture?
Honestly,
no, not at all. Not at all.
The Twitter, which enjoys a good TCM party, that's mm-hmm. their hashtag, mm-hmm. it's just like, so Leonard is not enjoying this Happiest Millionaire situation.
It's not very good.
It was very funny. That's so funny, though.
I mean, you know, yeah, you're there to present. You're not there to make a value judgment. They've already picked the programming, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Some of the pirate movies were like, okay. You know, well, some, you know, there was the fabulous Ty Power one. I can't remember the name of that one. And then the one with Maureen O'Hara and...
The Black Swan?
Yeah, that one's just smashing. I mean, you know, some of the pirate movies are really... The Errol Flynn ones are all good.
Yeah.
But some of them were, you know, dog-tastic filler... And a few Hammer ones, you know, from when Hammer did the pirate era. And, you know, you'd go, well, this next one's from 1956.
Yes.
Galleons at Sea. And you're like, oh, boy.
We have a
Can
couple.
You say Tortuga?
Yes. We have a couple, though, of these really, you know, I can't tell you how much I love this movie.
Yeah.
No one enjoyed it more than me. This is when you bring out those wonderful,
just,
well, folks, this sure is a movie.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Put down on film. By a major studio.
Yes.
And if you like Ben Nye, Number Nine, Arab makeup, you are going to love the Caribbean people in this movie.
Now you're speaking my language.
Dark Egypt from 24. Yeah, right. So, Greg. When did you first encounter the art, the world of improvisational comedy, otherwise known as improv?
I'm going to answer your question by ignoring it first and then going back to it. Which is something you should never do with Leonard Maltin, but I'm going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Then we were at the old silent movie theater on Fairfax, and that's mm-hmm. when we started doing the film club like five, mm-hmm. 7 years ago. And after the first couple months, Jennifer was like, why are you doing this? And I went, I like it. It's fun. And then she took it over. And I stopped programming it, basically, because the first movie we showed was Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, which is a favorite of mine. But the format wasn't set yet. It's 2.5 hours long. I talked for a year about like Lemley and like the dawn of film. I had nothing, you know, I had no idea what I was doing the first one. So then by the second or third one.
So is that the one which, wherever you go, there you are?
Yeah.
Yes, right. That's the one. Why does that stay in my cranium?
Because it's the funniest line in the movie. Yeah. The fight breaks out and Ellen Barkin's going to kill herself in the bar and Buckaroo Banzai, and this is it's for men only. I don't know. Do women ever like this movie? I only know two women who like it. My wife's like, really, that movie? Jeff Goldblum's hilarious in it. He's a nuclear physicist, a surgeon, and he leads a rock and roll band called the Hong Kong Cavaliers, okay? It's a comic book. And so Ellen Barkin's drunk in the bar, and she wants to kill herself, and there's someone boos or something, and Peter Weller goes, hey, now, don't be mean. We don't need to be mean. Remember, no matter where you go, there you are. And everybody, yeah. So anyway, I showed that one. And then, so to answer your question, I was in college at San Francisco State in 1953.
I went to San Francisco State.
You really?
Yeah, only for a little while, but yeah.
That's a fun place. I went to school there, and this was 1979. And I'd already done stand-up in San Mateo. I went to the College of San Mateo, or as we referred to it in the peninsula, Harvard on the Hill. And high school with ashtrays. And Merv Griffin had attended there. So... I went to State, and I lived in the dormitories, and there was a cantina where they served cookies and whatnot, not even booze, like because this was where the kids lived.
Mm-hmm.
Over, if you went to the student union, you could get a beer, but at this place was like literally like Kool-Aid, and this is the 70s, so
yeah.
It was sugar cookies and Kool-Aid and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I saw a sign that said improv. Show and I was like, what's that? You know, like I'd heard of it. I'd heard of the committee in Second City and stuff. I was 19. So I went and it wasn't on that night. So I went the next week and they did a bit where they called someone out of the audience and said, who will volunteer to come up and do an improv with us? So someone did and I watched it and I went, well, I can do that. So the next week I went back and I sat in the very front. You sat on the floor. This was college. And on the carpet. And my buddy Reed, who has been my buddy since then, since 1979, went, who will volunteer? And I went, I will. And I didn't give anyone else a chance. I walked right on stage. And we did, I think, and this will give you an idea of what year it was, a Mooney and a drunk at a bus station. A Mooney.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if you've heard of, know what a Mooney is.
I don't.
It's a disciple of the church of the Reverend Sung Young Moon.
Yeah.
Well then.
They used to be, you used to see them at the airports, bus terminals and the like. Yeah.
Okay.
And they would be caging money for his thing. And he was famous. He's still an entity. They're still a it was called the Unification Church. It's from Korea, and the Koreans are heavily Baptist, but he branched off into this weird, and he used to do mass marriages and stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were like, what was the other, you know, the Hare Krishnas for a while at the airports,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah,
then the Rajneesh before that all went to, you know, its explosive, horrible, tragic ending. Yeah, so that was a big joke in 1979, to be hassled by a Mooney at a bus station. So the next day I was playing pinball, again, to orient you what year this was, playing pinball in the student union. And Reed came up to me and said, hey, you were really funny last night. You want to be in my group? And I said, I do. And I had a partner there who's my partner, Forrest Brakeman, who I was in a comedy team with. And I go, my partner's pretty funny too. And he goes, no, I don't care about him. So eventually he joined too, of course. But so I did. I learned to do improv from the kids in that group at school. They were called Faultline Comedy Theater. Just get it. We're from San Francisco. And I didn't go to Second City. I didn't go to the Groundlings. I never went to any formal training. So they taught me how to play all the games.
What did you major in?
I chased girls and smoked a lot of weed.
Fair, sure.
I don't know if that's a, you know, the definition of my major.
I think that's what college is.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't acting, ostensibly.
Yeah, okay.
Which meant, you know, being in plays and or trying to be in plays. And then when you couldn't get in a play, you'd just do your own play.
I went to school for musical theater and jazz voice. So when I say I get it.
Yeah, you do.
When I say I get it,
jazz voice is that ill-defined, yeah.
Yeah.
There was another one called interdisciplinary something. CIAE or something was the department, which was adjacent to the acting theater department at State. And August Coppola was the head of that.
Huh.
And so it wasn't my, he wasn't my, what do you call them, guardian of the gates, whatever your college person.
Advisor.
Advisor,
thing,
yeah.
Yes.
But my buddy Brian Lohman, who was a singer, for some reason that was his major. So when he had meetings, he had to go to August Coppola's office, who's Nicholas father, is it?
I think so.
Yes. And Nick Cage.
Nick Cage.
Nicholas Cage's father. And I was like, what's it like going to Coppola's office? And he goes, it's great. He's got an espresso maker. So I would go meet with my advisor was named Kip Bacom. He was a Welshman, B-A-C-O-M. His real first name was J. Clyde, but everybody called him. And then I had another awesome theater teacher there named Mr. Terrell, who really helped me out. He let me direct plays, and he would drink with the cast after the show. He took everybody out, and he paid for everyone. So if you were in one of Mr. Terrell's plays, we would all go to the Lost Weekend on 19th and Terraville and get sauced, and he bought everything. And we'd eat those eggs from behind the bar that are in the jar and whatnot, and the little pepperonis and whatnot. And Mr. Terrell talked like this. He was sort of Lionel Barrymore. He's like, my God, Greg, I was at the Bohemian Club over the weekend, and I think I drank and smoked too much. And then he'd light up a Parliament. If you remember Parliament cigarettes, they have a little weird filter on them and the chevron on the box. And he wears glasses like this. He's quite big. I loved that scene because the meaning of what you did was crystal clear.
That's perfect. That's exactly what you need
for those in the listening audience. Greg just lowered his glasses to the edge of the bridge of the edge of his nose. That's the visual you'll have to just picture for yourself.
Yes, he was a corpulent and lovable, and he lent me money. He put in a word for me. He helped me out so many ways. But when you'd go to his office,
no espresso.
Out of the drawer, two well-fingered glasses, like a Graham Greene novel, you know, like a novelist who'd say well-fingered, and fingerprints in and out of the glasses, and a bottle of sherry.
Sherry, perfect.
Sherry.
I love it.
Because it's the daytime.
Yeah, of course.
It's the daytime.
Of
We're
course.
Not seriously drinking.
No, right. no,
We're
no.
just having a sherry.
Having a sherry.
Because at night, after the show, we'd go up Mr. Terrell and we would get smashed. And
right.
he was rich and lived next to the school. He walked to school every day. He lived in Park La Brea. So he just walked, put the same black suit on. And his other gig was he put on the shows for the Bohemian Club up at the Grove. Like they put on that weird, you know, they put on all kinds of weird theatrics up there. And as you know, they're the movers and shakers of the world. It's
Describe the Bohemian Club for those who are not in the know.
The Bohemian Club is an organization that has a big 19th century fancy men's club situation in the city of San Francisco.
In the heart of the city.
In the heart of the city. And up in the woods above San Francisco, they have their own camp where they have cabins that have funny names. And people like, Francois Macron from France, Jamie Dimon, the head of Sherson Lehman, these types, people who sit on the Trilateral Commission, people who are the king of countries, go there and act like frat guys.
Hmm.
And they urinate outside and they get drunk and they smoke cigars and they control the world. It's like the Council of 12 or whatever in the X-Files. That's where they meet.
And over the years, the Bohemian Club roster of members be a who's who.
It's astounding who attends the place. I mean, mm-hmm. If you went, and they don't let other people go much. It's a closed society. Mm-hmm. And women are brought in to do that thing. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. And I don't think you're allowed a cell phone. They have a bank of crap payphones at the perimeter. Mm-hmm. So you're completely cloistered when you're there so that you and George Shultz can, or is he still alive? He was a habitué. He was Secretary of State under Reagan and mm-hmm. head of Bechtel Corporation. So mm-hmm. he was a shaker of the highest. He is still alive because I saw him in a documentary about someone. In any case, they invited artists. So you would get a pass as an artist, and also the people who waited table there obviously weren't rich old white guys, so they'd get people.
Yeah.
Like you, right? So I'd heard from people who'd worked there, stories of the Grove, and then Mr. Tyrrell never really talked about it. But I assume he'd been connected with them for so long, and I have no idea who connected him to the Grove. Because he was a theater director and a professor at State, they put on these weird things where they burn death every year. Is it Care or Death? Care, I think it is. They have this weird effigy, and they burn it, and there's a ceremony, and people... Oh, yeah. These are the rich men of the world. And they're drunk. And so he would
Everyone has to let off steam, right?
Yeah.
He would go to the Grove and put on that show. But also, I think he went to the Grove downtown and drank with them, too, because he was... But I remember a guy telling me that he waited table there and that Nixon was invited. And I think it was post-presidency. And Nixon loved music, as you know. He played the piano, like Harry Truman, right? Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton played the saxophone, and this one, of course, plays the bones of dead children. And to him, it's sweet gospel music. And Nixon was... it wasn't a waiter. This guy was a musician, and he said he'd gigged there.
Uh-huh.
So they had a little jazz band. And Nixon got up and went like, oh, I love music. Can you please let me have a picture with you? And he goes, he was real uncomfortable and stiff in his usual dark suit and shiny shoes and cufflinks. Mm-hmm. And he asked for an instrument. So the sax player gave him his axe, and he said, I have a picture of me and Nixon, and Nixon's uncomfortably holding a saxophone under one arm. And I was like, that is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of, I have no idea. Oh, so that was at State. So we would drink sherry in the daytime and smoke cigarettes in his office mm-hmm. in those days. And so it was a fun atmosphere. And then we went out and did a group, and McShane joined the group, who was on the British Whose Line. And then Whose Line started in 88, and Mike went over. I was doing a gig with Tom Kenny, who you know, who's the voice of SquarePants,
Bob Steve.
Square.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
That's it, SpongeBob SquarePants. And of course, Tom and I go back 100 years. And,
yeah.
In those days, we looked quite a lot alike.
Yeah.
We both had giant black horn-rimmed glasses. Tom had a Woody Woodpecker thing going on.
Okay.
And I had the Buddy Holly pompadour thing going mm-hmm. on. And we were doing a gig together at the worst place in the world, some club in Spokane, Washington, called Railroad or the Underground or something. It was a fake New York deli in Spokane, which, of course, went over like a fake New York deli in Spokane.
Right.
Like mayonnaise on the pastrami, you know.
And, on white bread.
Yeah, you know, like, wow, okay, you're a deli, I get it. This is a place where nobody wants that food, you know, in those days especially. And McShane called me at the comedy condo we were staying at. And he goes, there's this English TV show in town, and they're auditioning for improvers. And where are you, man? And I'm like, and I remember like crying that I couldn't. So they came back the next year, and that was 89, and I was 11. And I went and auditioned for them. And I knew when I got it. There was three English people sitting in a little theater in San Francisco in the Mission District. And I got up to do some improv bit, and it was something that was a TV on stage or a mime TV. And I went, you see those buffalo? They're running for freedom. And I heard the producer burst out laughing, and I thought, oh, I'm in. I'm going to get this. And then, of course, he said, will you do the show? But like English people, Would it be all right if you came over? would it be okay if you came over to do the show? And I'm like, are you asking me to do the show? And he's like, well, if it's all right with you, we're shooting in July. And I'm like,
yes, over. I yes, got please. Going on.
And they made me stay for 2 weeks the first time. It was on their dime, and or their quid, if you will, and their halfpenny and
their pence. Yes.
Yeah, their pence.
Their pences. And,
so I stayed and I loved it. And then they did a Christmas special that year, which was the most unsuccessful improv show I think I've ever participated in. Instead of four of us, which is the magic number on Whose Line, right? It's always four. And yeah. then a couple, two, three musicians and a host. So that way the playing field's not crowded and everybody gets to play in a lot of games mm-hmm. and you get to see us all. This is I'm in a group with Ryan Stiles now, and I have been for 20 years, and there's four of us. You can do it with five or six. You can do it with eight and 10.
Yeah.
This is an improv town here. You go see groups in LA that have like 18 people.
Yeah.
But four is really the best number, especially for telly. And they decided to do six. So they added two people. Paul Merton, who's a friend of mine, is a famous comedian in England. And Tony Slattery, who's also a friend of mine and a famous comedian in England.
He's great.
And Tony was in a bunch of films at that point in his career. Clown Game and Peter's Friends and whatnot. Paul had a nervous breakdown kind of on the day. And I remember one of the improvs we were doing, we were visiting the Christ Child because it was the Christmas special. And me and him were the magi. And Tony pretended to grab the manger and throw it on the ground and stomp Jesus, right? And I'm thinking, as we were shooting, which the camera was rolling, this isn't going to go in the show. And I think that one also had, we used to do a game called World's Worst, where you step off a step. So it was the world's worst thing to say or world's worst, whatever.
Yeah.
And this was world's worst thing to say at a funeral. And Tony came off the step and pretended to shag the body and went, he's not dead yet. And that one was hilariously funny. The other funniest one ever that I don't think went out was Stephen Fry. Yes, Stephen Fry did the show. That elegant, erudite, over-educated wit, Stephen Fry, who I admire enormously. World's worst thing to say to the Queen Mother. And he stepped down very elegantly in his suit and he went, whop some skull on this bitch. Whop some skull. That was the part that I don't think I had ever recovered from this delivery on that one. And so we did the Christmas one, and Jennifer came with me, and we weren't married yet. That's how long ago it was. And we'd been in London maybe a couple of days, and I said, could you move here? And she went, yes. And then I went back
over. Then you knew you wanted to marry her.
Yeah.
So we got married, then we moved to England, and we lived there for about 5 years. And then we moved to Los Angeles. And
In England were you?
Huh?
Where in England were you living?
Well, all over London, but yeah. At the end, because we're Lovey's darling, we lived in Hampstead, NW2E.
Of course.
In a really lovely flat on Denny Road, and right around the corner from Belsize Park and all that jazz. It was much different then. It's so crowded now, but it was a little more villagey. There were still coffee houses and junk. And I mean old English ones that were awful.
Yeah.
I don't mean like Starbucks. I mean like what an English person's idea of a coffee house was from the 70s. They call it a coffee shop and you'd be like, oh, just like a dire omelet and really bad filter coffee, which they thought was hot stuff because they'd still give you Nescafe if you went over to their house.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, we ended up spending years there. And then Whose Line, you know, my God, we did 10 years on British TV, then 4 years on ABC. And then the CW brought it back, and we're in our seventh season there. So we've had 30 years.
Yeah.
Wowee.
Yep.
Wowee.
And there was a time, I mean, it's always fascinating with television as shows come in and out of popularity. You know, you think about a show like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where there was a time when we all sat and watched it.
Yep.
Everyone sat and watched it. In the same way of whether it was Ed Sullivan or whoever, this is what you did. Whose Line, and I was a theater kid especially, we watched every single episode.
Sure.
And then we watched it again. And then we watched it again. And on off days when your teachers were tired, they'd have you watch it.
Really?
Again, yes. Yeah. Always, because it was so great. And it was also really interesting to see, you know this well, not everybody can do improv.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you bring in someone who's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you get into this whole universe of somebody can be funny. That does not mean that they can perform. Somebody can be funny. That does not mean they can do improv. They may not understand how to do all the rest of it. But when a name is a name,
yep,
that's when the people putting the TV show on say, but it's so-and-so. You go, okay, let's watch them die, but okay.
Yep. There was on the English one, they put Jonathan Pryce on one. And he's an actor of some you know, rare talent on screen. He was adrift. Mm. And it's a terrible, terrible feeling because there's nothing you can do. You can only try to jolly them along as much as you can because our scenes are 2 minutes long, at the most three or four. And we cut everything to death, and the ins and outs are really important. That's what we spend most of the day doing is shooting ins and outs. We don't we play like 25, 30 games.
Expand on that.
So Dan Patterson and Mark Levison, who concocted the show by ripping off improv games they saw, found the perfect method after a while. The first year we did it in England, we would take 3 or 4 hours to get one episode. So after a few years.
1 hour episode?
One half hour, one which half is 23 and a half minutes in England.
Right.
And here, by the time we got to the American one, it was perfected because we'd had 10 years in England. So the way we shoot a show is if you come to see Who's Line, I don't know if we're doing another season, so I shouldn't. Although I've been saying that for 30 years now. The host, Clive in England, Drew and Aisha here, Aisha Tyler and Drew Carey, have to announce every single game. So I will go if I'm Aisha. And now Leonard and Jesse are going to play sound effects. So you stand up. And then at the end of that, we'll be right back after this. So every single in and out of every game is produced. Mm. So any game from any part of any show can go anywhere in any show with any other game. You see what I mean? So it's 27 games or whatever, 28 games. We play a lot of games. And then we do songs and stuff like that. But it's imperative that there be a way to leave the scene mm-hmm. by going back to the host and a way to come back from that scene and then to see us get up to start that scene. So we play all the games, and that takes about an hour and a half. So the tapings are fun for the first hour and a half. And then it turns into Showa in the second half. It turns into this interminable, you know, this long foreign movie where all you can think about is your personal comfort and I wish I'd gone to the bathroom and why didn't I bring water and I was high when I came and now I'm not high anymore and I don't have any food and they won't let us eat and it's too cold in here. And I've seen people fade under the, you know, we have to keep it going.
Yeah,
sure. And then the second half is an hour of us standing up and sitting down with doing just jokes off the top of our head to keep the audience from shooting
losing
us.
Their minds, yes. Yeah.
And then Dan comes down and yells at everybody because he has the sort of that engaging wit of a TV producer, you know. So it's like he'll just go like, we've got to get a laugh here, you know. And he'll just say to the audience, laugh here. And they'll go, ha, ha, ha. And so that they can have a clean the applause.
This is all about television production. For those of you who feel maybe a little left out at this moment, these are all the mechanics.
Is this interesting, or have I just dissected everyone here?
Not at all.
No, I see.
I just want to make sure everybody gets what you're saying. Is that the core content of that show are the skits, the sketches, the games.
And it's real. It's real. You guys are doing it, and it's funny. Yeah.
I hope it doesn't make it sound like it's produced like we actually engineer the
improv. No.
We play the games in their entirety. But then after we play the games, in order that you may see the games in order, they have to have ins and outs.
They have to have a proper introduction and a proper out-troduction.
Outro. And sometimes it's me at the desk, so continuity. You know, we'll goof around, and sometimes Dan will put me over at the desk or one of the others, or Aisha will get up, and one of us will jump behind the desk.
Yep.
So that has to be accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just shoot that and then never, ever talk about it again, because then on the night when you show the show, the person's not there that was there.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of thing.
But this is all part of what TV is its own animal.
Yeah.
You know, you could do improv in real life. In a theater, it's completely different to doing this, these kinds of pickups, these sorts of things. And, of course, staying on.
That's the thing. By the fourth hour, we've lost the will to live. And we're basically throwing stuff at each other and swearing and flipping off the producers.
The other aspect, when Greg says the audience, it means that the people, the civilians who've come in as your audience to genuinely laugh, and provide a soundtrack, a sound bed for the show, they are now getting bored out of their minds because the mechanics are very dull for an audience.
Yeah.
That's not what they came to see.
We don't have a warm-up person because we're...
You're it.
We are the world. So the producer Dan goes out and, you know, riffs a little at the beginning. And then we do the show and then we're on for the whole. It's not, I mean, it's fun that it's a TV show. On the road, when we do the live show, we did it in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival. We just finished a month there. And I did it with all the English guys and Clive and everybody. You know, we sing, we dance, we goof, we do slapstick, we fall on the ground. So if you come and see us, we're real funny.
Yes.
And a little bit political, but it's not wedged in. You know, if there's a room for it, we'll do it. It's not my stand-up. You know, my stand-up, I can be a scathing, scabrous, political animal. But
where did you perform for Fringe?
At a place called McEwen Hall at the Utter Belly, they call
it.
It's at Bristow Square, where the Gilded Balloon is. Beautiful August theater with its just fabulous, like, pipe organ and red velvet things all covered up.
Yep.
So they've built bleachers inside, so you can't see any of how grand this place is, other than it has a fantastically high ceiling so it doesn't get too hot.
Yep.
Jesse is a veteran and graduate of the Edinburgh Fringe
Many
Festival.
Years of Fringe.
Now, where do you play when you're there?
Oh,
it's
well,
a long time, but
the first time I was 18, and we were at a venue that's no longer there called Rock. Well, it's still called Rocket Venues, but it was something else.
Right.
Then I went back, and this is actually where I met my husband. We met working at C Venues, which used to be the biggest venue on the Fringe, and I was doing press and marketing for 210 shows.
Uh-huh.
Went back, I've been a lot, but
you know
I
what the Fringe is, and it's a madhouse of
it's
entertainment.
Insane.
It's 5 million comedians, 5 million plays, ballet, dance.
In
symphony,
every space
film,
that isn't a space, every bathroom, wherever you can shove a show, they'll shove a show.
My big improv joke was we were doing Party Quirks, which we only do on TV. And the group with Ryan, we've never done Party Quirks or Hoedown in 20 years, and we never are going to. But we did it for this show because it was, you know, the British one. And I'm always the guy who guesses. And I kept... Clive would go, oh, well, Greg's getting the party started. And I would walk out and go, oh, this is, I'm staying at my flat in Edinburgh, which is also Venue 183.
That's right.
Which is a huge joke in Edinburgh. It's not funny to you guys listening, but if you were in Edinburgh during the festival, literally, there's a liquor store down the street from where we stay sometimes that has a sign that says, this is not a venue. dear actors, this is not a venue.
My first time we were living in the dorms at the University of Edinburgh. And
which is beautiful.
There was an Italian group above us who kept setting off the fire alarms by smoking indoors.
Right.
And what we learned was when they'd call the fire department, which would happen every single night, all the girls thought that the hot Scottish firefighters were delectable.
Uh-huh.
So then people would purposely set off the fire alarms in the middle of the night. So you'd come out at 2 a.m. in your pajamas and someone else is magically like, makeup, hair done. I was like, do you think you're going to meet your husband on the green out in the middle of the night? Yes, you are. Okay. But Underbelly and Utterbelly are both, I mean, they're known for the comedy stuff and they get the best of the best.
Well, we had one comic, you know, you were talking about it, and I'm not going to say who it was because no one needs to know. But we had one guy sit in who was a famous comic in England from TV. And, you know, he got there on the night and we all went like, look, do your greatest hits. You know, we haven't worked together before. Don't be afraid to just use what you need to use up here because we got to get through. It's an hour show. And he goes, right. And first bit, and then it was like pig farmers, and then Stephen Frost, who's been on the show 100 years. He's the big pig. When he talk like this,
he's great.
Goes, well, if we stretch the pigs, we can get more bacon out of them. And so big a rush, let's make more money. And this comedian goes, and you're going to love this one, Jesse, because this is improv in a nutshell. Why on earth would you want to stretch a pig? Which, if you were teaching improv, it would be the one thing you'd stop the class and go, okay, what you did there was derail the scene without adding anything to it. If you'd said, why on earth would you want to do that? Because we're salmon fishermen.
Right, right.
Or because I'm the queen.
Right.
Or we're taxi drivers.
Yeah,
but no, he just asked the worst question on earth. The scene, so Frosty ignored him. Carried on, and then he said another question, and he kept underpulling everything, and it never stopped all night, and he was terrible.
Man.
So the next day, I wrote the producers and said, that's not going to happen again, and here's what I'd like you to do. And I have no authority. I'm just speaking for everybody.
Yeah.
By the way, I included the cast in the email. I didn't just go to the producers.
Right.
And I said, there's some women that we did it with us before. How about having one of them back? And, and then I got a big apology, and we were told he could do it. So either he lied or someone lied or nobody lied or they were lying.
So, Greg.
Yes.
What is the biggest difference between performing and doing the show in England and doing it here in the States? And I guess the larger extrapolation from that is, do people react to the same things? Do they laugh at the same things?
They do. There's only differences, I think, the references.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ask for a film style here, you're going to get, Western, musical, whatever. Mm-hmm. Although Western's a little archaic. Sci-fi, horror, definitely. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, one man will always go, porn! I yelled porn in a room! And in England, we have that as well. Someone will always yell porn. And,
but with a different accent.
But yeah, there you get Bollywood.
Yeah.
Way more, because Bollywood is a staple of British entertainment. And not quite as much anymore, but occasionally, Carry On, which is a genre of film. It's a series of very broad British comedies that were made through the 50s?
Well,
60s, 50s, and
70s. 60s into the 70s, yeah.
There's an 80s one. There's one from the 80s.
Yeah.
Or 90s.
We wish there weren't. But
yeah, they made it a couple last ones. Right. And camp actor named Kenneth Williams, who'd go, ooh, nice. And, it's just as, it's boob jokes and, it's really bad. And they're called Carry On, so it's always Carry On, like Up the Khyber, or Carry On Spying.
Yeah.
So that you would get. And then on the old Who's Line, we'd get Clangers and all their little TV shows, Magic Roundabout, things that they knew that we don't know. So an American is adrift. So I had to learn all those things. I had to learn what a twiglet was. Fortunately, I could do a John Major impression when John Major was PM, so I got away with that quite a lot on the show.
Because John Major talked like this. Hello, Leonard. I quite enjoy your work.
And all I had to do is come up and go,
hello.
And then I'll just lose it.
I have glasses. And John Major had glasses.
Oh, my God.
So that's the major difference. The other one is, and I was talking to my wife about it, much to her chagrin yesterday, is we sing greatest hits in our show like we do on the telly, right? And when I'm on the road with Ryan's group, Ryan and Jeff Davis sing together, and I sing with Jeff sometimes. And if Ryan's not there, I sing with Jeff and blah, blah, blah. We were doing it in Edinburgh, and we pimp each other to what the song's going to be. Like, if I'm sitting at the thing, I'll go, well, this is a classic that I think you'll remember, whatever. Sometimes we do characters. I'll do Matthew McConaughey or something. I'll go, if there's one thing I like, it's I loved a jazz. You know what I'm talking about? You're sitting in a room and it's like a torpedo flying through space and all of a sudden you burst and an avocado opens up and that's the moment when you should have ordered barbecue. And, like that kind of abstruse. And then, so they'll sing the song. And, but in England, we were doing Tom Waits and Dr. John.
Mm-hmm.
And a little more arcane, and the Scottish crowd was all over it.
Mm.
And we did operetta, so we sang. I sang in cod Italian, and cod means fake. Like that kind of nonsense. And then so that's a little different. We wouldn't do that necessarily. And I've got to do Tom Waits once in our show because I can do Tom Waits. But we did it. Me and McShane did dueling Tom Waits in Edinburgh, and it went over a big story.
Yeah.
But here he's a little mainstream taste doesn't include some of the people that we love.
Yeah.
Meaning, I do Jeremy Irons, and it's one of my better impressions. But when I do it in the group with Who's Line, two people get it. Mm-hmm. When I do Matthew McConaughey, everyone gets it.
Yeah.
So there's the across the board stars.
I'm gonna need a little bit of that. Please.
Of Jeremy Irons?
Yes.
Jesse, your hair color today is absolutely breathtaking. I hope you don't mind if I say that it's exciting. Is that your hand? Or is that my hand? Were you rolling a cigarette? What were you doing there? You were terribly naughty, wasn't it? So I'll go, I'll take places in Europe for 500, Alex. But I do it, and then the crowd's like, and Joel Murray's in our group, who's a wonderful actor, and his brother's Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel can do all of his brothers. So he can do Brian, and he can do Bill. And he does them very well because he grew up with them. So, he'll do Brian. Oh, no, and then his Bill is, hey, will you do a line from Jaws, Bill? We're going to need a bigger boat, So we do a lot of that goofy junk. But Bill Murray, of course, is famous to everyone. So
yes.
One night a woman said her favorite singer was Tom Waits, and Jeff Davis very graciously turned to me and went, will you get up and do it? Because he can't do it. Because you have to do the, la la, with the pants on fire, Never recognize yourself on heart attack and blind. But no one's asking for that. There's not a lot of call for it. So when I got to
we're happy you did it here.
Thank you. Doing it in England was great fun for me, and doing Dr. John and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is. It's. I always look at it as two different languages.
It
really is. My husband's English, and so going back and forth as we do, it's like
windscreens and serviettes.
Honestly, I land and everything just switches. It's a small one. Mm-hmm. People will say, "Do you magically get an accent?" No, I'm not Madonna.
No.
I don't magically think that I'm British. I just change what I say, so I don't have to get yelled at all the time.
Absolutely, and there's a whole sub. You need a whole subset of words and language to get through, because people will walk up to you and go, "You're right," and that just means "Hi, how are you?"
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't mean "Are you all right?" And you don't have to say "I'm all right. Thank you for asking. How are you?" They go, "You're right." They say, "Oh, Jess, you're right." And then, in order to get you to do something that's absolutely bloody awful that you don't want to do, they go, "Leonard, are you happy that to be in the green room for the next 5 hours with no food?" They'll put it that way. Are you happy? And it's like, well, are you you're making me declare my unhappiness.
Yes, 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 yes.
Which, of course, yes, I'm quite unhappy to do that. I don't want to do it. And then they'll say, well, on the night, the ones that have come over that I've noticed in the 25 years since or 30 years since I started going there are vetted. That was very V English, as the British would say. V, a little bit, has come over. Full stop.
Oh, that's a big one.
Is now part of American language, but mm-hmm. it wasn't before. English people always said full stop.
But people still don't think of it as a period.
Mm-mm.
They now hear. So when I first went over and was working at C venues and I had to be writing stuff, they would say, "Make sure you put full stops at the end of each sentence." And I said, "What the hell is that?"
Right.
And I said, and they show me on a keyboard. I said, "Oh, periods." They start laughing. That's what women get, you know. And it was one of those things where I was like, "There's no way to explain what you want because there mm-hmm. isn't a." Mm-mm.
I've learned so much from my son-in-law.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, we live together, you know, and I thought I knew, you know, you call a truck a lorry, you call an elevator a lift. I thought I knew the key differences, but boy,
mm-hmm.
I keep learning more and more and more.
And I've got a northerner.
Oh, yeah.
My husband's from Manchester, so that's a whole other.
Akid. Yeah, Akid. They call you Kid.
Why didn't Akid pick you up at the airport?
And they say, "There's the bunny."
There's a whole heap of
Manchester's really wild. Mancunian is.
Yes, the Manx.
The Manx, and then there's the Brummies.
Brummies are what they call anybody from the Midlands.
Ah, okay.
And then, my buddy Josie Lawrence from Whose Line. Is from,
I love her.
Yeah, she's lovely. And her accent's black country.
Yes.
And so they don't say could, they say coshed. Yeah. That's their accent. Yeah. So she'll do these sentences. She'd do it for us, because obviously she's dropped her black country accent. And the black country name is Wanda. And Eshkosh, and Akoshkosh, and have some pork scratchings. Like, they talk like that. It's
wow.
Real. And then my friend.
Oh, another phrase that's been adopted by Americans, over the top.
Over the top?
When I was growing up, I never heard that
really?
Expression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh.
And now
the Brits say it.
Yeah, yeah.
We stole it from them. And on my podcast, I use quite a lot of British lingo because it makes me sound hip and cool and erudite. But I've forced on my public, pitched up. Mm-hmm. Bold up,
mm-hmm.
Car park,
mm-hmm.
Lift, mm-hmm. meaning elevator and mm-hmm. parking lot.
Right.
But I'll say, "We pitched up, they pitched up, he bowled in." Like, that just means you showed up. And then I'll use, you know.
You say rocked up?
What?
He rocked up.
No, I don't.
Rocked
I don't
up to this place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't used that one.
It's one of my favorites.
The pranit, all the pejoratives.
Yes.
Woody, pranit, bark, wet. Someone's wet. I love that one. They're a bit wet. And Jennifer's favorite one is jolly hockey sticks, which is a description of a person's personality, by the way, meaning kind of a good time Charlie rich idiot. And the other one that they use for men that are rich idiots in England is Hooray Henry.
Mm.
And then one that we read in the paper once that was so funny, the shouty girl from the fourth form.
Yes.
They say people are shouty. And I brought that in too. I call people shouty.
Oh, yes.
And because no one ever said it that way here. Mm-hmm. So I've stolen everything from there and use it on my podcast constantly.
And why not?
I like dogs bollocks. Yeah, the being dogs good. Bollocks. Oh, that was the dogs bollocks.
I've learned. Yeah. All right. And also on Twitter, it helps because you can say bollocks to something.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean quite what it means there.
No.
And then my favorite one that I've stolen from England is do jog on. Because you'd never say it in jog conversation.
On.
Yeah, but you would write it. Definitely. Yeah. Jog on.
Jog on.
And it's just a great way to say
F off. Get jog lost. On. F yeah. off.
I get it.
Like, on your bike.
Yeah, get on your bike.
On your bike.
Yeah, yeah. Get your skates on.
Yeah.
Exactly. Inference was clear.
Get your skates on. That
get
one's like,
what?
On.
Okay.
So
I will tell you, my father-in-law loves to say things knowing I don't understand.
Yes, of course.
And it was the first time being at the house, and I come downstairs, and he's in the little living room, and is everything closed.
Lighting a fag on the cooker while he's using the Hoover?
Basically. we had our Henry. The Henry was out.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And there's everything's closed doors.
Yeah.
I've learned, if anything, in England, it's all shut
always,
doors
always
everywhere.
Always close the door, yeah.
So I walked in, and
so
I didn't.
So it can be stifling.
Exactly. I didn't close the door, and he goes, put wood knoll.
Yeah.
I said, pardon? Put wood in hole. Yeah. And he loves to do that. I said, what? And he goes, put wood in hole.
Yeah.
Put wood in hole. Shut the door.
Yeah.
So that's a personal, that's for my father-in-law, Andy. Thank you.
If anyone is still listening to this
yes.
episode of
the podcast. Of Arcane Drek, my
that's
new
right.
album.
We're going to have to bin this episode.
Ah, you like
right
that,
about
don't you?
Because the clock on the wall is saying it's time.
Gonna have to bin it. See, well, I just got back from a month there, and I've been saying y'all right to people, so I had to quit saying that.
Right. Oh.
And then Robert Smith from The Cure was on the plane on our way back, and he walked by me in the airport, and I went, "You're all right, mate." Which, of course, I would. Oh yeah, you're right. We have to bin it. But in my little improv group with Ryan Stiles and them, now we all say our.
Mm-hmm.
Is our Leonard here?
Mm-hmm.
Is our Joel here? Where's
mm-hmm.
our Joel? Where's our Bob?
Oh,
we
okay.
use that, which is something English people always do. We don't say himself, or meself or anything like that. But it's crept into everybody. I noticed there's a little bit of the lingo going on now because we've all been to England.
Yes,
and Ryan, of course, was on the English show for 10 years, so mm-hmm. we all know it. So we say things like that in our group.
My mother-in-law jokingly, so with the hour, it's Al Liz,
mm-hmm.
as in Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, Al Liz.
You know, well, Al Liz was on TV last night, and it's just like, oh, that's amazing.
Do you remember Daphne on...
Dude, of course, yeah, Frasier, I watched
And she had the worst Mancunian accent in the history of mankind.
Because it wasn't a Mancunian.
She's not from there.
No, nope,
she wasn't
not
doing
at all.
One at all.
Yeah. No one knew, though.
No, because...
No one knew.
What it meant.
We're Americans.
Yeah,
that's right.
We're
she sounded British enough.
Right.
That's all that mattered.
This hour has just flown by.
Oh, thank you.
And what a treat to see you and to hear you and to enjoy your rapid fire wit, sir.
How kind of you.
And if people want more of the same, where should they go?
Thank you for asking, because I have a plug at the ready. GregCroops.com is where you can download the Greg Proops Film Club and the Smartest Man in the World podcast. And coming up, speaking of film, I have the great privilege of being in Nightmare Before Christmas, which I was in when it came out. I'm several voices in it. And Danny, the last few years, has decided to do it live.
As in Danny Elfman.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Our Danny. Danny Elfman, who wrote the score and sang the score. Chris Sarandon did the voice of Jack Skellington.
Speaking voice, right.
Danny did the singing voice. And I made the picture with him in 92 or whenever. Gee whiz. And... now we do it live, and we did it at the Hollywood Bowl last year at Halloween. We're not doing it at the Hollywood Bowl this year at Halloween, but I wanted to tell your listeners, because I know you have listeners everywhere, that in December, we're doing it in Glasgow, London, and Dublin.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
And we did it in Tokyo in May. And so we do it with a live orchestra with John Mautrey, who was the conductor mm-hmm. of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra for 100 years, and was head of the Royal Opera in Glasgow as well for 7 or 8 years. He's our maestro. Catherine O'Hare comes and sings Sally.
Yep.
And Ken Page comes and sings Oogie Boogie. And so we show the picture. Then we stop and bring on the stars. And they come out. They do their turn. Then we carry on showing the picture. And we stop. And then we say, so it's, as John says in his sonorous, dolorous, beautiful, mellifluous tone, live to film. Ladies and gentlemen, The Nightmare Before Christmas. So it's really good fun. And I get to sit. I stand... if you're John, I'm mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm.
So every downbeat, I'm at in front of him, so I don't miss any cues.
Right.
And John is hilarious and sings the entire score the whole time. And he sings the songs with me. I sing them to him, and he sings them to me while we do the show.
What a wonderful opportunity.
I'm right in front of the strings. My heart is in my throat the whole time. I'm exhilarated.
How large an orchestra?
Huh?
How large an orchestra?
Full on, full on. Wow. We were with the Tokyo Symphony Orchestra in Tokyo. We play with the L.A. Philharmonic or whatever. We're going to be with the Scottish National in Scotland. No, it's legit. It is legit.
And Richard Kraft, who puts on the whole thing. We've had Richard on before.
I didn't mention many moons ago. Laura Engel and Richard Kraft work with Danny. And Richard, this was, I think, his idea maybe even.
It is, yeah.
And he does the sing-along.
He's very proud of that.
They did a Nemo this year. They do a bunch of stuff. Kraft. I met at the TCM Film Festival. We were all at a screening of The 12 Chairs. And he came up to me, and we started talking.
He's a fanboy.
Yeah.
Richard is a fanboy.
Then we decided The 12 Chairs is an awful movie, which it's kind of dull. And then I got the gig doing the thing, and then Richard was there, and he's really lovely.
If you look back, folks, on our earliest, among our earliest editions of Malton on Movies, you'll find Richard
Kraft. You'll find Richard Kraft, K-R-A-F-T.
Yeah, very interesting fellow.
And Danny Elfman was one of his very first clients. He sought him out, he's remained.
Yeah, he told me at a rehearsal a couple years ago, when we're in town, we rehearse over at Warner Brothers Soundstage, which is really awesome.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn, we rehearsed downstairs at the hockey rink that we played in. I can't remember. Big arena where, you know, Paul McCartney plays and whatnot. We did Brooklyn a couple years ago. That they auditioned a whole bunch of different people for Oogie Boogie, including David Johansen and whatnot, and that none of them were quite right. And then when Ken Page came in, he murdered it. And they were like, this is the one. So I didn't know that because I wasn't there for the audition process or anything. So I get the thrill of working with Catherine O'Hara. And you know,
I love that woman.
Wow. Well, folks, we're going to say goodbye for now. We're going to remind you where to find us.
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff. And we are also now on Patreon. We call it the Maltreon. And if you look it up, it's Patreon/Maltin on Movies.
And that's how you can
cinema.
Help us.
Yes. A cinema, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
And that's how you can help us continue doing what we do. And we really appreciate your support.
And as my mother-in-law says, go to the pictures.
Yeah, the pictures.
She still says, go to the pictures.
I call them pictures, too.
Yeah. Everybody laughs. I believe in that. Absolutely.
I always call them pictures. And people are like, do you mean movies? I'm like, yeah, you know, the pictures.
The pictures.
Well, we'll see you at the picture show, then.
That's right.
Take care, folks. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.